I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
Frank Fiore back with us. He's the author of Cyberkill. It's a novel. It's a techno thriller now converted into an enhanced digital ebook. As a matter of fact, it should be one of those things that you don't want to put down. Frank's a best-selling author with more than 50,000 copies of his nonfiction books in print. His writing experience also includes guest columns on social commentary, future trends, published in the Arizona Republic and the Tribune Papers in the Metro Phoenix area. He's got a BA in liberal arts and general systems theory from Stockton State College, and he's got a master's degree in education at the University of Phoenix. Frank, hey, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you so much for being here. You know, we talk Cyberkill. We are so technologically advanced today that it seems as though that would just fit right into the psyche of the majority of the people out there. Where'd you get the idea for this?
Well, I got the idea from a Time magazine article many years ago. It talked about a young programmer, artificial intelligence programmer at MIT, of course. And he wanted to create a series of artificial intelligence agents, software agents, and send them out onto the internet and let them evolve and just see what would happen. And I thought, you know, what would happen if those AI agents went out onto the internet and really evolved and learned and became sentient? And what would happen if he decided to shut down that experiment, you know, out there just programs, of course, and one of the AI agents took his attempt at shutting down his project as an attempt on his life, and that AI agent decides that he was going to seek revenge on him. It's like Frankenstein myth redone.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, after that, I'm never turning my computer back on again. they're after you. You know, by the way, as a serious writer, author, obviously you're professional at it, the ideas, did they come just like in a moment of that aha, that's something to write about, or you look at something differently and all of a sudden it begins to happen? How does it come to you?
Well, I have a file cabinet filled with a dozen file folders, and what I do is I come up with an idea, mostly on things that I'm interested in. I'm interested in technology. I'm interested in skeptical science or skeptical concepts of parapsychology and things like that. I'm also a big history buff. And so the ideas come by, and I say, gee, that would make an interesting story, and I throw that idea into the file folder. And then over years, I would run across an article or a website or a news piece or what have you, and I'd clip it, and then I'd throw it in the file folder. And then over time, that file folder gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and when it gets big enough, I look at it and see what I have, and I create a plot out of it.
Okay, so effectively, it just starts to grow and to build. One of the things that I've noticed, which is very interesting, especially with authors today, there was a time where you had a book, and that was it, and you had to buy it from someplace, order it from someplace. Now you get the mobile apps. You can go iPhone, iPad, Android, whatever the case may be, and you can read anywhere you are and anytime you want to and just turn the thing on and off. I think this in and of itself is absolutely phenomenal for besides the reader, but for the author especially. It's a way to social network, to expand way beyond what people could do 10 years ago.
Yes, I agree. It's it used to be called, it's now, that's an archaic name, but it used to be called the always-on internet. And it is. Anywhere you go now, you could plug into the internet and you can do whatever. You could surf the web. You could connect with people. I mean, look at the young generation, and what I think they call the millenniums. They're constantly in contact with one another. You can't sit at a table with them without them texting constantly and finding out who's doing what where. And to some extent, it helps me too, because social media, I can connect with people and ask them questions about ideas I have for my book. It's just wonderful. I mean, I don't go to the library anymore. The Google is my research assistant, and I can do everything through Google and my network in order to find out what I need to know in writing my stories.
No, by the way, I want to read something from your press release because it'll tie right into what I want to say. I was looking at this, the geographic locations, government, military installations, organizations, information warfare scenarios, artificial intelligence, robots, and the information and communications technology. They're all in the book. They're very interesting. We talk about science fiction. I really wonder today if there's anything called science fiction. I would the technology that we have behind us, the majority of the things that we talk about are actually a literal physical possibility.
Well, it's the science fiction has the uncomfortable act of becoming science fact real quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially these days. I just received an email from a friend of mine. If you're familiar with Galactica, which is the Galacta, which is the science fiction movie about cloning and about manipulating DNA. And they just found out now that there's a company that will eventually be able to give you your complete DNA genome, your complete one, for $1,000.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
No. And actually, I can't. In the end result, I think all of the technology is wonderful. The only problem that I see with it, and I don't want to stray off subject, but the only problem that I see with it, it takes you away from humanity. You talked about, people are on their Blackberries, their mobile phones, texting constantly. It's taken away from that human touch, and little by little, we seem to be losing that inside technology. Good, bad, or indifferent, that's what's going on.
Well, it's how you look at it. I mean, are you really? Yeah, you. There may be the flesh to flesh touch. But you're still connecting with human beings, and I remember, 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, even 25 years ago, they said that the art of writing was dead because nobody wrote letters anymore. When all of a sudden, email pops up. Now, you know how many emails are being sent around the Internet? People are writing like crazy.
No, absolutely. And I'm watching kids sit there next to each other, and their fingers are going a mile a minute, and they're just flowing with whatever it is. And they get so concentrated on it that nothing in the world actually matters at the time. Okay, let's go back to the book for a moment. The core of The Cyber Kill is what? What is it about that book that's going to keep me involved?
Well, unintended consequences. That's really what the book's about, where the main hero, Travis Cole, the NSA, military, they all have these projects, all doing these things, and they think they have complete control over it until they find out that they don't have control over it. Travis Cole doesn't have control over the AI, which he thought was just a program. Right? The NSA thought it had control over Cyrus, which is the genetic weapon. And the U.S. Army thought they had control over the communication system that was and Cyrus, which was completely secure. As it turns out, that the AI was able to get into it. So the whole idea of unintended consequences is one of the key plots, or you might say, a concept of Cyberkill.
Now, by the way, when you take a look at this, this isn't so far out of the realm of reality that what we can do, what we can be dealing with today, especially in our own government with so many things that we don't know about. But when the left hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing, and one area gets stronger than the other, and they weren't aware of it, I think you've really got the same thing going on today at a much lesser impact.
Well, that's a fallacy of controlling technology. We convince ourselves that we can control technology. In reality, we can't. Technology is just a tool, and when it falls into different people's hands, it's being used for different purposes.
No question. And by the way, what have you got coming next, or is Cyberkill going to become a series?
Well, if you read Cyberkill, you'll see that the ending does point toward a sequel. I left it that way. But the last three books I have just written are a series, a character series, about a critic or a someone who is a critic of parapsychology and conspiracy theories. And he's a debunker, but he's drawn into a specific conspiracy theory or or some sort of a situation where he has to pursue that particular wacky theory because of a threat to his life or a threat to his family or to his reputation. And so those three books basically are thrillers, and they show as he walks through going pursuing one of these conspiracy theories and that there's an element out there or an organization that he stumbles upon who are trying to stop him from pursuing this crazy theory, but he doesn't know why, because it connects somewhat to a real event or a real conspiracy that's taking place in the real world.
You know, I've always thought that you take a guy like yourself with your ability to create things, the way you think about things and you put it to pen. You've got, you know, the backlog. You got the file cabinet, quote unquote. I wonder how dangerous that is. And when I say dangerous, you could come up with ideas that are going on right now and somebody's going to want to shut you off up there.
Well, you know, like I said in Cyberkill, I wrote the book, and just before it was published, the Fars news agency from Iran accused the United States of creating a genetic weapon. And of course, the Department of Defense denied it, but that genetic weapon is in the Cyberkill. So well, there you go.
No, I hear you loud and clear. So realistically, you can write it, you can create it, you can do it. And if it's got anything to do with anything close to reality, you can end up having a problem there. Now, when Cyberkill gets going, what's next on the agenda? What have you got sitting there ready to rock, the thought behind Cyberkill?
Yeah, well, like I said, I have these three books called The Chronicles of Jeremy Nash up at my publisher. And one of the books is a 2012 End of Times book where Jeremy Nash gets involved with pursuing the Hopi End of Times prediction for 2012. He finds out that his parents did not die in a caving accident, but were actually murdered for what they found in that prediction. So now he has to pursue that prediction, even though, of course, he's a debunker of that. He doesn't believe in that kind of stuff. But he has to pursue it in order to find out who murdered his parents. And the first book of the Chronicles is called A Taste of the Apocalypse. And his grandfather leaves him a strange note that says that there's a diary that exists, and that diary will point to where the body of Jesus Christ is buried today. And, of course, that's a bunch of hunk, a bunch of phooey. He doesn't believe it. But yet, if he doesn't return that or give that diary to some religious cult who kidnapped his sister, they would kill her. So now he's forced to go and pursue that, what the diary says, in order to save his sister. And the last book, The Black Sun, he's accused of murdering a crypto historian who stumbles across a plot to create a second Holocaust in Europe, and he has to pursue that theory that there's Nazis at the bottom of the Antarctica. There's a Nazi base down there, and he has to pursue that in order to find out how to stop this plot, the second Holocaust that's going to take place in Germany.
By the way, Frank, you must have drove your parents nuts when you were a kid, and they would say, "Why were you late?"
You know, when I was raised a Catholic and attended Catholic grammar school and Jesuit high school, and Taste of Apocalypse, the first book of the Nash series, I get my chance to get back at the Jesuits. But when I was in there, I was always accused by the nuns that I lived in a dream world. Frank's always in a dream world. He doesn't pay attention.
Actually, when you come down to it, thank goodness. You know, realistically, when you're a kid and you get hit with all of these things, if they could forecast the future, to realize if you're that strong with it, there's got to be a talent in there somewhere. And instead of trying to bury it, they should open it up and really get creative with it.
Yeah, you would think so, but that's just not the way it happens. Well, maybe it's better that way. Maybe that hardens you and say, hey, I know I'm good. I know my ideas are good, and I'm going to pursue them no matter what you say. You got to have a thick skin in the entertainment industry, whether you're writing books, whether you're writing music or singing, or making movies or anything like that. You got to have a thick skin, because you're going to get tons and tons and tons and tons of rejections. And just look at any successful author, any successful actor, any successful singer or anything like that, think about all the rejections they had to go through to make it. And it hardens you and really steels you to say, I'm going to make something out of myself. And if you got the talent, you'll do it.
No, I hear you loud and clear. Frank, we're just about running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, www.frankfiore.com. That's FrankFiore, frankfiore.com. And I also have a blog, which you can, a WordPress blog, which you can reach through my main frankfiore.com site.
Wonderful. Hey, Frank, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, listen, thank you very much for having me on.
And take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Martha Everett ran up with us. She's the author of Step Over Rio, a mystery suspense novel about child trafficking. She's a writer. She's a poet. She's a child advocate. Worked as a nurse at Houston's Ripley House. And in 1984, founded the nonprofit organization Child Advocates Serving Abused Children. She's received numerous community awards from organizations such as Inc. Magazine, Entrepreneur of the Year, the State of Texas, Houston Young Lawyers, and National Court-Appointed Social Advocate Association. And let us say, Martha, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we look at the border and we think of, you know, the border between us and Mexico, and everybody's screaming and yelling about the drug trafficking or people coming over that, you know, that they're illegals and so on and so forth. I think what we really haven't taken a look at is the human trafficking, and that is going on, and for some reason, we're burying it.
Well, it's not a subject that people enjoy thinking about, I think that, well, when I first started researching it, I had become aware of it through my work with abused and neglected children in Houston, and I realized that no one wants to read a book about statistics on trafficking. So I started thinking about writing a novel, a mystery suspense, and I was fortunate enough to work with two agents at the State Department who helped me discover the exact procedures that occur in trafficking cases. And then I had worked with some kids that are trafficked, as I mentioned, and they told me about some other cases that I used as composites in my novel. So the young boy is a Guatemalan boy who escapes from Guatemala because there is a death squad actually after him, and he comes to the United States and escapes from a trafficking ring and is aided by an agent with the State Department, a very hard-nosed reporter, and a mysterious shaman who all have the goal of bringing down this child slavery ring. Houston is one of the hubs for trafficking in the United States.
You know, it's amazing when we deal with this, when you think of human trafficking, you know, the first thing that comes into your head is female. And that's not necessarily the case. There's a lot of young boys that are involved in this also. And it's something that I'm going to say again that's overlooked. I think it's brilliant the way that you're doing it, because if you put it forth in a novel, you're right. It's not statistics, etc. And then you get interviewed about it, but it also brings that point up to the public eye. You know, we can view it. We can take a look at it now. And again, in all of your studies, all of the research that you've done, is there any reason why we don't pay attention to it? That's not an easy question.
I think that it's societal denial of evil, which I believe that we do with many different issues, not just trafficking. And it's just the human condition, Michael, and it takes a lot of hard work and creative thought to bring the issues to the forefront. When I started in the child abuse neglect field in the early 80s, and I used to give talks to people, breakfast clubs, professional clubs, people would say, that doesn't really happen. This isn't really a huge social issue. And now today, 30 years later, we know it's a huge problem. So I think that denial is a part of the human condition, and it's always a challenge to bring these social issues to the forefront.
Yeah, it wouldn't be so much denial if it was somebody's son or daughter either, but we don't look at it that way.
Well, no, and you saw the movie Taken with Liam Neeson, you know, and that's an isolated incident of trafficking that does happen, no question about it. But there are estimates that up to 800,000 people are brought across the United States borders and into our ports a year for not only sex trafficking, but also for work on ranches, plantations, restaurants, all kinds of indentured servitude, where they're forced into service, they are not allowed to leave, their families are threatened, they have to give all their salary up for room and board, and they have no hope of ever getting out of the situation they're in.
And we look at this, and this is supposed to be 2012, where these things have been over with. You know, we have fought slavery, we fought the indentured, etc., you know, for years and years and years now, and it finally, quote-unquote, gets over with. But it's not over with, and I think that's the shame of the entire thing. Also, to what happens to those people that are involved. Not only the youngsters are involved, there's human trafficking in adults, too.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. The United States Homeland Security has a newsletter that they send out to anyone who wants to give them their email, and they send me a newsletter every morning, 5 days a week, and the whole first page are trafficking cases that are being prosecuted in the United States, and the second page are international trafficking cases. So this is becoming the awareness of it is huge now, or is becoming, I shouldn't say huge, it's becoming a larger issue. But some of the people that I have talked to that are in the field, professionals, think that it is the second most lucrative crime next to drug trafficking in the world. Because human trafficking is, you sell a drug and it's gone. You sell a human and you can reuse them for years and years, whether
sure.
It's in sex trafficking or labor.
Well, and I hate to say this, but it's the old adage, if you want to find what the problem is, you follow the money. And that normally
will
take...
Well, you're right about that.
Oh, yeah. All right, let me ask you this. Well, let me create a scenario here. You are the Queen of America. You have the magic wand. You can do anything you want to do. and you have control over everything. How would you stop it? What would you do? What was your first step to get this stopped and controlled?
I would organize a task force to determine who the customers are of these traffickers, then go after the customers, not the traffickers, but the U.S. citizens, the U.S. corporations, the U.S. ranches, farms, sex traffickers who are using these people, and stop it that way. And you know, that's what actually happens in my novel as far as one incident of the crime in terms of going after the people who are behind the crime rather than just the people that are transporting these kids or adults into the country.
I think one of the biggest problems that we have, when I said early on, follow the money, and not to be political, because this transcends all the administrations. This isn't something that just happened in 4 years. This is something that's been going on for years and years and years, and it's gone through every administration that we have. Republican, Democrat, doesn't really matter which way that you're going to look at the or what side of the aisle that you're on. So the most important thing is, it's whatever is stopping it has been universal. And if there's dollars flowing, somehow administrations, current and past, have been stopped in their own way from taking a look at this and handling it. Because if somebody wanted to do it, if the president of the United States, forget it's Obama, it could be anybody, if the president of the United States decided that this is not the right thing to do and he created a task force like you were talking about, it would stop. So there's something that we are not seeing that's going on that seems to be, quote-unquote, up to this stage, uncontrollable.
Well, I think that when you look at the labor force that is brought into this country, then you can see the economics of it. And then if you look at the United States as one of the largest purveyors of child sex trafficking in the world, and so we have a huge market here. And yes, the president can say, and both Colin Powell as Secretary of the State and also Hillary Clinton have policies and have taken stands against not only international trafficking, but trafficking of U.S. youth. And the fact is that regardless, there are huge pockets all over this country that are benefiting from this crime, just like there's huge pockets that are using the drugs. So when I said a task force, I guess that just would be the beginning of this.
Oh,
it's
sure.
Huge. It's a billion dollar business.
Unbelievable. And I say that, obviously I've been aware of it for a long time. I've done, various interviews over the years about it. But the problem, and I think the real problem is this, if you and I would have interviewed 10, 15, 20 years ago, I would hear the same thing and you would hear the same thing out of me, and then we would interview again today and we would say the same thing, and nobody is doing anything about it. So I think the key is not necessarily the awareness, but why to stimulate some kind of a call to action to get this thing controlled or taken a look at. So we've got all of these different areas going on, the subject matters going on for this presidential election. I haven't heard this one time.
Well, I guess that the way that I've decided to approach it, because I've done child advocacy for over 30 years legislatively, is that I believe that one of the quickest ways to get people to react and take action is through the media, and whether it's the written media or video or whatever. So my hope is that this story of this one boy saga, and he's not the only child in the story, there are girls in the story too, that these children's experience, because it's not gross numbers that you can't even get your hands on, but you understand what's happening to these kids, that it will motivate people to say, hey, this is a huge issue. And it'll also enlighten people about how the federal agents work with each other, with local law enforcement in order to combat these kinds of situations, and also who the criminals are. Because the criminals are right in our backyard. They're not some secret, trafficking lord that's hiding out, in the mountains. There are people that probably that we know.
Okay, and these people, quote unquote, these people are the people who what are they? They're like what's the word I want to use? They're like an employment agency. That's probably what they would have to be, because there's got to be an order in for what people want in humans, and somebody's got to be there to direct it and the people who bring them in. So there's got to be a central area that distributes. I hate to use that word, but that's really what we're looking
for. Well, I think that's one possibility. I also think that there are people in particularly, like I mentioned, in the agrarian industries that have need for workers who contract with middlemen who bring people in. I think that there are, of course, in the sex trade, it's completely different, using cantinas, massage parlors, widespread networks that appear to be legitimate businesses who traffic underage girls and boys. So it's not just one. It's a more complicated crime, like everything else, than just this is the company that's doing it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure, absolutely, because there's got to be a process or a strategy behind it. If there wasn't, it would have went down the tubes years ago. But if they follow the process, that's what keeps it alive. That's what gives it its impetus to live over all these years and, quote-unquote, thrive. And it's very interesting. We're screaming and yelling about, you know, the job market and the unemployment and so on and so forth, and yet we have to bring people in, either illegals or human trafficking, to cover some of these, you know, the farm jobs, the agrarian jobs you were talking about. So somewhere, somehow, this has got to be looked at. And if it's in the farm industry, farm, ranch industry, et cetera, then they should be targeted. There should be investigations.
Well, that's one industry. But remember that meat packing company a couple of years ago that was closed down in the Midwest? And, I mean, there are the huge office building cleaning companies, and I'm not saying all of these people are using trafficked individuals. Please don't get me wrong. These are just certain kinds of companies that may employ trafficked individuals. So it's really hard to just say that it's one industry. And that's why I think the FBI now has a specific trafficking division in almost every state. There are probably 300 or 400 nonprofits now. When I started writing this book in 2003, there were very few resources for trafficked victims, and now there are hundreds of resources in this country. And there are hotlines for trafficked victims to call, and there are also hotlines for people to report trafficking. And so it is happening, but there is a widespread network of customers in this country for all different kinds of jobs for these people.
Oh, got that.
And the tragedy is, pardon me?
No, go ahead. We're starting to run out of time.
Well, the tragedy is that... Oh, are we out of time? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead and finish your thought, please.
The majority of them think they're coming to the United States for a legitimate job. they don't understand, and particularly the girls and boys aged 12 to 14 that are being brought in here for the sex industry. I mean, they think they're coming here to... either waitressing jobs or working in a home. They have no idea what's getting ready to happen.
Wow. Well, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at, find the book.
It's www.marthabraniff.com or my publisher, waythingsare.com.
Wonderful. Martha, thank you so much for joining us tonight and the work that you're doing. And this microphone is open to you anytime.
Well, I appreciate it, and I really enjoyed meeting you, and hope to talk to you again.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Hugging you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're wrong. Yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Fred Clarkson with us, the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between, he listened to it, Theocracy and Democracy. He's an independent journalist, an author, and a lecturer who's written about politics and religions for about 30 years now. He's the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between, again, Theocracy and Democracy. And let's say, Fred, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, in today's world especially, well, the subject is all over the place. Sometimes it's hidden, sometimes it's subliminal, you don't see it, but it's out there. What was it about the subject matter that brought you to do what you've done about it?
Well, I was living and working in Washington, D.C., in unrelated matters when the Reagan administration came to town. And we used to call the element of the religious element of the conservative movement the new right in those days, but there was a flood of conservative Christians who suddenly turned up, and I was wondering, what is all this about? And as an independent journalist, I began poking around and discovered that, wow, there was really quite an ideology behind a lot of what we were seeing in mainstream conservative Christian politics that was a throwback to the 18th century and a nostalgia for a time before the Constitution was written, and we had 150 years of colonial theocracies. And quite a few prominent people thought that was a pretty good thing.
You know, one of the most important things that we can look at when we look at religion and politics today, you know, the Constitution basically said that the government can't take one, I'll make it simple, can't take one religion and make it the religion of the country, and they really haven't done it. But I think the confusion for most people have been the minute somebody says religion, it's running the government. And there is a difference between democracy and religion. There definitely is. There's no question about it. But there's that, I guess really what it boils down to is the problem is, who do you follow? You know, where's the, and religion is in and of itself, it's a culture. What culture do you follow when you listen to your heart? Are you, you know, have you become somebody who is going to stand up for the country, or somebody who's going to stand up for what their other beliefs are that might stop a forward movement of a democracy?
Well, that's the wave that we're always surfing, isn't it? The how we relate our faith to our life, or in this case, our national life.
Sure.
And when the framers of the Constitution got together, they had as many differences as all of the rest of us, but they were learned men. And they'd seen what had happened in Europe with religious persecution and religious wars and elsewhere around the world. And they saw what happens when you pit my God against your God in the public square. Yeah. And they saw the persecution of people, of how some people became second-class citizens and worse. The Salem witch trials were not the only bad thing that happened in the colonies.
Sure.
One of the formative experiences of the young James Madison was witnessing the beating and jailing of Baptist preachers. Just because Anglicanism was the official church in Virginia, and it was illegal to be a Baptist preacher. So how we reconcile these things is a choice. We have to decide to understand that we live in a pluralist society in which there are at least as many religious opinions as there are people, and that the right of individual conscience resides with us as individuals, and we can believe what we will, change our mind as often as we like, and we have to respect that in others as well, because if we don't, that's where we begin to go wrong, when we forget that other people have the same rights as we do.
You know, realistically, and I think I've said this probably 10,000 times on the air in the last year or so, that, you know, the country itself, we are one of the most powerful forces in the world. We are the most powerful force in the world. Toe-to-toe, Fred, you can't stand up against us. So if you want to take care of us, what you do is you cause us to implode. You separate. You separate the ideology, the religious theology, and so on and so forth. And that's really one of the things that we're not looking at. You know, you said it all. You know, my God against your God. And when that starts, you have a division. And then when you start dividing it from there between the races and the genders and so on and so forth, there's such a weakness that's created. It makes us very vulnerable. And I really believe if you take something like what you're doing and allow people to stand back and take a look at what's going on, they might make some different decisions. But if you're not aware of it, and the culture says you do this, you jump on it, and you don't think about it, and the separation happens.
Yeah, it's easy to pit people against one another. One group is deemed to be of Satan, people who are trying to somehow demean or challenge or undermine our God. And by golly, the original intentions of the Founding Fathers to boot, they're not just somebody down the street who has a different religious view, they're traitors. They're maybe demonic, you know, out to grab your children, do God knows what with them.
No, absolutely, no question about it.
Against each other in ways that make us mortal enemies.
No, absolutely, and I think
harm to one another.
Yeah, and it's intentional. There's where the problem is. If I get you to hate somebody to go along with what I have to, with whatever my agenda is, then all of a sudden you're doing something and you think if it's for a cause that is above you, and if you really look at that cause that's above you, quote unquote, none of these things would happen in the first place.
Yeah, we're often looking for scapegoats for things that are not necessarily somebody's problem. It's all of our problems. Things happen, and it's always the scapegoats are always going to be the less powerful, the less popular, the people whose points of view or their religious views are not sufficiently majoritarian, and that's a great danger. That's a great danger when we start to view things that way and look to as a source of our problems of those other kinds of people, those people we don't really know very much about, those people we don't quite trust.
Well, let me ask you this. I pick up the book, Eternal Hostility, and I read it page by page, cover to cover. Fred, what do I get? What do I, Michael Ray, get? What do I walk away with that I didn't have before I read the book?
I think you get a perspective that they probably haven't seen before, because what I tried to do is to step back with a historical view and see what's been going on when political leaders like Pat Robertson or Newt Gingrich say that America was founded as a Christian nation. Well, was it? What's the right answer to that? And as I combed back through history and it came forward again, I thought, nope, we're being demagogued. And so you come away with a perspective, as you were saying earlier, that people are being propagandized, and you find out why. And you find out who's being demonized and why. And you also get factual and intellectual tools to begin to respond, and a few ideas about what you can do as a citizen.
No, but that's getting to be a very interesting thing. What you can do as an individual citizen today almost seems to become diluted, as far as you were talking about this, you know, I'll say it in different words, to demonize someone. If you come up with an idea that's yours that is not a popular idea, you're going to get torn apart today. You're going to be literally ripped apart. They're going to go after you and your family and everything that you stand for. And I think we've come to a point where if you have something really decent to say, something that people need to hear, you're going to say it, but who knows what the backlash is going to be.
Well, people do live in fear, and that's one of the problems. I mean, there is some real violence that goes on out there, but it's the fear of violence that stifles us and prevents us from becoming full human beings, fully sure. realized citizens operating in the marketplace of ideas and in our political culture. We become withdrawn, and it allows the loudest and most bullying and most dangerous voices to take the lead in our culture. And that's something that none of us can afford to allow to have happen.
Now, let me ask you this. What was the purpose of the book? When I say the purpose, if you and I sat down and had a cup of coffee, what would you want to tell me? What would you want me to know from the writing?
I would want you to know that we have a rosy view of what's happened in our history. We had a glorious revolution and a constitution that enshrined the rights of all and a First Amendment that was going to allow free speech, and by golly, we're the greatest nation in the world. Well, we may be that, but there's one thing we often forget or we don't notice, and that is that the Constitution, as written, was vigorously opposed by many people. Ratification was opposed by a good third of the population, and the main reason was because it didn't acknowledge God or Christianity, and it provided for equality among people, whether they were Muslims or atheists or Hindus or whatever deviant form of Christianity one of us might hold. And that's the basis of democracy right there. It's equality of belief under the law. And so...
But Fred, let me hold you up.
That faction never gave up. They're still with us today, saying different things. The actors have changed, the institutions have changed, but the arguments are the same. That's why we have the subtitle, Democracy versus Theocracy, because there are people whose theist views utterly clash with the idea of a leveling of citizenship on the basis of belief.
No, okay, by the way, let me state this, because I listened very closely to what you had to say. We started out, and it wasn't a Christian nation, it was a Judeo-Christian nation. That's how it was created. That's what it worked for. That was the majority. And we built it based on that. Now, to have another religion come in, whether it's Islamic, Muslim, whatever the case may be, and to inject their way of life and their culture into the culture that we live with today, now all of a sudden you have to stand back and say, what is going on here? Are we ready for that kind of a change? And is this something that we want? I happen to be Jewish, and I was raised in, everybody I knew was Christian. We celebrated Christmas. We had Christmas trees. We exchanged presents. I was brought up in a culture that caused me to be who I am and why I am today. And the moment that that gets taken away, and I object to that, and I object to that strongly, and not even, you can't have the mangers and the rest of it and so on and so forth in the schools, and you can't sing Christmas carols. The problem with that is it's an attack on the culture. Not necessarily saying that somebody else is bad, but this is the way it's been all of these years. And when you take, I think it was Oklahoma just today, they had some problems with the Sharia law. They stopped it there, and the Department of Justice just blocked that. Now you've got Sharia law, which happens to be religious, that has to do nothing with our Constitution, going on in Oklahoma today. There's where I think the problem is. We are who we are, and if somebody wants to come here and be like us, be like us. Don't try to make me like you are if you've come from someplace else and you've run away from that place because you were in fear of your life.
Well, I'm not sure that there's any danger of Sharia law breaking out anywhere in the United States, including Oklahoma. I think mountains are being made out of molehills there. I will say this. Muslims are an important part of American culture and have been since the founding. When Thomas Jefferson authored the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which was the model for the way we approach religion in both the Constitution and the First Amendment. He wrote in his autobiography that he said, you know, what we were trying to do there was that the protections in the Virginia statute were going to apply to Muslims and Christians and Hindus and Jews and infidels of every denomination, he said in his,
sure.
In his words. We have always had religious equality at the basis of our constitutional approach to citizenship.
Yeah, okay, but I think where the problem is, and I'm not, this doesn't have to be, you know, an anti-Muslim or Islamic whatever, but I think the problem here is our Constitution is not religious. The law that they that drives them, that's the base for what they do, is a religious law. The Sharia law is based on their religion. There's where I think the problem is going to be between what's accepted here and what's not accepted. That's where the key is. The religion has nothing to do with the Constitution and the rule of law. And yet we've got a segment of the population who doesn't believe that. And that's not what we were founded on.
There are many segments of the population that don't believe that and never have. And I might add, never will, because they're serious about their beliefs. And the problem, as it is, in terms of imposition of the values and the views of sacred text,
sure.
Is not really a Muslim phenomenon, as it is a Christian phenomenon. And I say that as someone who comes out of the Christian tradition. We have people who would really like to see biblical law implemented in the United States in much the fashion that it was during the colonies.
No question. No. By the way, absolutely no question about that. There are some people, but I think when you really come down to it, we are, and well, I take that back. I don't know if we are anymore, but we have been a nation with the rule of law, and slowly it's becoming a nation for the rule of man. Geographic location, time and place is based on what's going to happen to you if you break the law. It's different in California than it is in New York than it is in Florida or in the Midwest. So I think that's where the problem. We've lost our standardization, and quote unquote, there's no more rules anymore.
Well, I'm not sure we were ever quite as uniform as you make it out to be, but but I will say, in terms of the notion of equality, like I say, the First Amendment didn't wipe the slate clean. We still had books or laws on the books well into the 20th century. For example, in New Hampshire, outlawing Catholics from holding public office. It wasn't enforced, but it was a part of the state constitution. It's taken a long, long time for us to integrate basic constitutional principles, basic laws, major decisions of the Supreme Court, you name it, the standards of which you're talking, into our lives. The standards that we espouse, we haven't been quite as good at upholding as we might have liked to.
No, and I hear you loud and clear. By the way, we're running out of time, and this conversation could probably go on for the next 2 days. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
You can always find me at talktoaction.org. That's word talk, the number 2, action.org. And the book's out of print, so you have to go to Amazon.com. It's a pretty reliable source for cheap used copies. But you can find my writing at talktoaction.org.
Wonderful. Hey, Fred, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you look on from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Oh,
I am sure whoever told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Joe the Biker with us, Joe Wanzek. Joe, I hope I pronounced your last name right, is currently an executive.
Wojcik is...
Say it again?
Wojcik.
Wojcik, thank you. I got it. It will always be
okay.
Great.
How are you tonight, Michael?
I am good. How are you? Hey, listen, if you're a biker guy, you're my kind of guy. 1974, if you'd have been in the San Fernando Valley, you would have seen me on Hill to the Hog, which was a... which is a 1200 Harley, and it was it had a molded frame, square from beginning to end, 18 inches over, and we were rocking.
Ah, all right, sounds great to me.
My kind of guy. All right, let me ask you.
All right,
when we talk about bullying, all right, where was it that you first got bullying experience when you were a kid? What happened?
Yes, I'm 60 years old now, and I still can remember the experiences I had in grammar school. My nickname was Yubby, Y-U-B-B-I-E, and the kids were really mean. I've been beaten up with plastic baseball bats, were humiliated, and really had kids beat on me and torture me for a number of years in grammar school, to an extent that I even considered taking my life a couple of times when I was a kid.
That's okay. We had a little bit of a connection. But realistically, when bullying comes down, I'm a little bit older than you, and I remember bullying in the old days. Bullying in the old days, when I was in school in the 60s, was, you know, somebody pushed you around, they beat you up, and that was about the end of it. But over the years, it got worse. It got to a point, Joe, that you're right, just like you. They pushed you into a point of taking your life. Recently, some of the bullying examples that I've seen, there was some young girl that took her life. There were the people who were bullying her were standing across the street at her funeral and still yelling. I don't even get this anymore.
Well, you're right. It happened all the way back when we were young, too. It has changed its dimensions today. I think there's a lot more in the media. But at the same time, there's also other venues that they can bully over, like cyberspace and the way it's handled by the schools. I think bullying, even back when we were kids, has an effect on us as adults. It lowers self-esteem. It lowers self-confidence in an individual. And if you're not nurtured through that experience in a positive way or choose not to walk away from it, it can have long-term effects also. But today, yes, it seems to be much more rampant. And I think the reaction is because of the way children watch TV and the way our culture is, they think of taking the extreme steps, which we've seen in a number of cases.
I think one of the biggest problems that we face today when it comes to bullying is when these kids don't tell their parents. They hide it. And sometimes it's too late when you find out. How do you tell signs that indicate that your child is being bullied and you hadn't noticed before? What do you look for?
Critical. It really starts at home. And it starts before the child even enters the first day of school. So many times people want to blame the schools, but it really starts at home. And when parents spend time with their children, you know, that's what changed from our time to today. We used to sit down and have supper together. Mom and Dad, we'd sit down every night. We'd have a conversation. Today we have sometimes two parents working. Children are not having that communication. So it really, when a parent start seeing a child not talk, withdraw, maybe not eat right, maybe try to take different ways home from school, not maybe inviting friends over. Those are the signs. And those signs will start showing up in that dimension. But if you're sitting down spending time with your children, it's easier to pick up the slightest changes in their demeanor, that something's happening in their life. It may not be bullying, but something's happening in their life that needs to be pursued.
Okay, but let's look at it from the other side. The question would be, what do you think causes a kid to bully that person on the other side? What is it that causes them to have that quote-unquote mean streak? And a lot of times it's vicious.
Same answer. It starts at home. In the majority of cases, schools do not make bullies. Bullies are made at home. Something's happened in that child's life that's causing them to come to school and act. Something. We don't know exactly what it is. It could be the way their parents deal with conflict. It could be neglect. It could be how their siblings at home are treating them. It could be a variety of issues. So it does start at the home, and it really has to do with parental nurturing. Bullies, as I tell the kids when I'm up in front of them, no one's born a bully. When you were in your crib, everybody was perfect. People are developed into bullies, and it's because something's happening in their life, usually at home, that causes them to act up at school.
But, okay, how do you stop it? Okay, let's do a scenario here. I'm your kid. I'm quiet. I've got all the signs. And one day you see something that triggers that in you, that recognizes something's wrong with me. You and I sit down. We talk. I unload. I tell you what's going on. How do you get me to, quote-unquote, bully-proof me? How do you do that?
Well, I think the first step is right on the head. You created a relationship with your child that allows them to communicate with you. As you mentioned earlier on, that is the most difficult part, and that's how you bully-proof your child. Number one, having that channel of communication so open that if something happens in that child's life, they will come home and they will share that with you. A lot of the times, the other ways of bully-proofing the child is building self-confidence. I wrote a song, and I do a rap in the school called It's a Name, Just a Name. A lot of times, bullying starts with just name-calling. So how do parents deal with conflict in their life? If somebody's mean to them, do they turn around and say something bad about that person? Well, then most likely, if their child goes to school and somebody calls them a name, the natural reaction is to call a name back. So when the child has good, healthy self-confidence, they're capable of letting it roll off. Just roll off, walk away, do the proper thing, go and tell an adult. So that's a critical part of bully-proofing the child, is building that self-confidence and having those channels of communications opened at all time. And critically, children have to understand, and a parent plays a role in that also, is that it's the bully who has the problem and that they're okay just the way they are. And these are some of the most positive ways you can bully-proof a child.
Yeah, I'm going to ask a question, and I want to say this with the deepest part of this, where this question can come from. When you're dealing with it, we're in a so happy era right now. You have a problem, you open your mouth to somebody, the next thing you know, you've got the attorney standing at your doorstep, or you're getting suspended or thrown out of your job. I mean, we have that today. So how do you stop it? Let's say, for instance, that your child sees somebody bullying. How do you stop it without that kid getting into trouble his or herself?
Well, most of the schools today have a system in place. After the recent incidences where children have taken their life, they have things in place where people can go and report bullying anonymously and that the school will take action. Remember the child's age, too. You can't go and turn around and sue a child that's in the fourth or fifth grade. So that's imparting information to the administrator at the school or to a teacher. So I think it's important that we as a culture look at, we all have a responsibility. We're all part of a community, and we have to take steps in order to stop the bullying. And that's how we do it. We unite as a community. We don't tolerate it, and we report it. And that's what we want to instill in our children.
Joe, with all the kids...
It's a little bit different when you're in the adult world and you're in the workplace. Bullying is a whole other topic altogether.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. But with all of the kids that you've talked to, what kind of reaction have you got? Have you looked in their eyes? Have you seen what you're saying? Have you seen them take advantage of it? Have you seen it sink in?
Well, I'm going to, right now, I normally don't do this. It's only because I just got an email from a student that I had in Massachusetts when I was there, and I'm going to read you his response. His response says, and this is, proves my point, take care. I really enjoyed your presentation when you went to Mountain View Middle School in Goffstown, New Hampshire. I'm in high school now, and I couldn't ever thank you enough for your help so I can do what you say I should do. I really hope you're enjoying it down. He knows I moved to Florida. I have so many more friends now. Your advice and how I'm doing now at school was critical to a change that took place after your presentation.
You know what I think causes that? No, Joe, go ahead.
Huh?
I was saying,
no,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. You know what I think causes
that? It illustrates how a child, and I have them so many times, I try to empower children to stand up, to be okay just the way they are. They're perfect. They were born perfect, and they're still perfect. They have to feel okay about themselves. When they feel okay about themselves, they're capable of standing up for their rights. They have a right to be in that school. They have a right to be there safe, and they have a right to be protected. I have had student after student after a performance that I do come up to me, tell me of a situation that happened at school that the principal didn't even know of, and I usually call the principal over and say, hey, let's have a conversation. That's because they feel okay when I talk to them, telling them that, hey, you have a right. You got to stand up for it.
See, the key here is this. It's called acceptance, obviously, and permission to be themselves. And most of these kids have a little bit of a problem with that. And it's like any subject, whether it's money, whether it's relationship, whatever it is, Joe, they don't teach this in school. So when you run up against it and you haven't had anything to anything laid in front of you, any strategies to say, this is what you do in case this happens, they're in trouble, and they don't teach bullying in school. That's why guys like yourself who do what you do can turn around and save some lives. Because if some of those kids can hear it and they feel it's okay, they got somebody to go to, quote unquote, which would be you in that moment, then they would know it's okay to talk to their parents. It's got to be okay. You got to give them permission. And once they give themselves permission to understand it, to work against it, to pull the family in on it, and they know that's okay, all of a sudden the world turns around.
It does. Michael, I can go even a step further. I have a program called Say No to Bullying Today. There are 6 chapters, and everything we just discussed is touched on. It empowers children and makes them feel okay with themselves. It builds self-confidence. There's activities around it that children can do. There's this dialogue that is created because there's homework assignments that children go home and talk to their parents. And so my program, Say No to Bullying Today, actually is exactly what we have talked about. It creates a bridge between all those areas. And it improves dialogue between a child and its parents and their willingness to feel okay about themselves.
You know, this also does one other thing, too. It brings that challenge, that painful experience that the kids have, and turns it into something decent. And when I say that, with many of the kids, unless they got bullied, and I'm not saying bullying is good, so please don't hear that, but unless they got bullied, that wouldn't have been that step they could have taken to be able to get that bond going with their parents. Maybe sometimes it takes that to do that. I don't want to see any kid hurt, but at the same time, if it's going to be that and they can turn and understand what it is that they're going through and that their parents are truly there, then all of a sudden the bully turns out to be a gift in and of their own way.
I also help children empathize with the bully. And that's, we want them to understand that they're okay, but it's really the bully that has the problem. And that somebody has to help them understand that. And I believe that dialogue with the parents. Children make a choice when they're bullied. I made the choice of not saying anything. I made the choice of internalizing it, which became very self-destructive. If a child can go and release it to their parents, you're right. There could be something very positive. Actually, a parent's job is nurturing and helping a child deal with conflict, and that's what bullying is. Bullying is a conflict. Somebody says something to you. How do you handle it? Do you get back into a fight with them, or you have a word fight, or do you do the proper thing, stay cool and calm, and go and tell somebody? So there's all positive effects that can come from any type of conflict in a child's early life, and it's really the key is to have a parent nurture you through that experience.
Okay, let me take this a step further. You mentioned it early on that bullying at work is completely different. Do you deal with that also, Joe?
I do. I have done seminars on bullying in the workplace, which is a very challenging situation because the difference is that you have to be, if it's a superior, because bullying in a workplace doesn't necessarily mean a superior. It could be a peer. But if it's a superior, it really depends on the culture of the company. People want to go and report it, and we usually recommend that they go 2 levels up. But if it's the culture of the company to get results by any means, then it's a kind of a self-defeating process. usually I start the seminar saying that the best way to solve bullying in a workplace is probably considering another job. And I go through a whole 2 hours and really come back to that same thing, because it's very stressful. It creates a lot of emotional distress that affects people's life. So if you want to attack it in a workplace, you've got to feel good about yourself. You've got to be ready to take it on, because it is not as easy as going up to your principal and saying, hey, somebody's picking on me, or having your parents call up and say, hey, my child's being hurt at school. In this case, it's a whole different situation.
No, by the way, we got a couple of minutes to go, and there's something. I just went to your website, and I took a look at something, a cup of Joe. Is that actually something monthly where there's a Q&A, people can get involved in it? There's a reason I'm asking that, because there's a critical point I want to make.
Well, people are asked to respond to my newsletter. So typically I address particular issues that people can respond to, and if they do, I will turn around and answer them.
Wonderful, because I think one of the biggest problems that we have today, you get somebody who's bullied, somebody who's this, somebody who's that, whatever the case may be, they go through the seminar, the workshop, the whatever one time, and it's all well and good, but it's the follow-up. It's the consistency of the follow-up, and I think the cup of Joe is a good thing, because they know they got a place to go to ask a question if they want to ask one.
Michael, I get phone calls from parents, and I nurture them through this experience with their child. I teach them on how to approach the schools, how to talk to the administration, and this works quite effectively, because typically a parent reacts emotionally and they get upset, and so they convey that when they talk to the principal or the contact person at the school the first time. They really have to go in there with the attitude of being calm and trying to work together as a team to resolve it. And I believe in follow-through. Typically, if a parent does call me and I try to help them through the initial experience, I make follow-up phone calls to make sure that things went well and that the child is okay. And that is, at the end of the day, the most important thing. Parents have to realize it is not their perception of what is happening. It is truly the child's perception and how they see what's happening in their world. We as adults use much more logic than they do, because they haven't even developed the wiring yet until they're about age 22 to use logic.
Oh, I hear you loud and clear. We're just about out of time. Website we can find you at?
www.joethebiker.com.
And by the way, when you said the biker, you know, it hit me. I haven't thought about my bike in so long, but it was a 67 shovel head, 1200cc, 18-ohm, molded frame, 12 foot from wheel to wheel.
Wow. Yeah. Do you still have it?
Oh, no, it's gone. That was, what, 40? A long time
ago. Well, okay. You got to get yourself another bike and get back on the road, because one of the things I enjoy the most, I do have a passion for riding, and I enjoy to go out there, especially down here in Florida or up in New England, seeing the beautiful countryside and taking in some fresh air and some beautiful scenery.
Got to tell you, I'm in the Midwest now, right outside of Milwaukee, and every other person and grandmas all have bikes. My goodness. Hey,
well,
listen,
you better go and down to your Harley dealer and pick one up.
I got it. Hey, Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
It was really my pleasure, Michael, and you have a great night.
Take care. Good night.
All right, bye-bye now.
And follow your star, brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought. That was it. Michael, I can't even say that anymore. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sam Rose with us, the founder of Rose Nutrition Center in Los Angeles. His 20-year career, he's consulted with many of the top names in Hollywood, appeared on NBC, Fox, the Discovery Channel. He's hosted a weekly radio program in L.A., written many articles for local and national magazines, and provided nutrition commentary on syndicated radio. Sam, hi. Welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Sam, when we talk about nutrition today, most people think of food, they think of diet, but they really aren't aware of how critical nutrition is. You eat the right things, your body works. You don't eat the right things, your body doesn't work. I can't think of anything, any way more simple to say it.
Well, I think most people have an overly simplified view of nutrition, for one thing. I consider nutrition to be everything that nourishes the body, which is what we eat, how much sleep we get, how active we are, how well we manage our stress, and how successfully we keep toxins from accumulating in our bodies. So it's really not quite as simple as making sure that we just eat whole foods, although that is a great first step.
Oh, sure. I think where I'm going with that, Sam, is that food, that your body is an electrochemical factory. Based on what you put in that body, it's going to go to where it's supposed to go, to either allow it to function, and if it's not the right stuff, it's going to make a disconnect. And there comes your depression, your overweight, your the fatigue, and all the rest of it. And I really believe nutrition is the key to health. I mean, the absolute key to health. What else is there that shores up your immune system? Did I lose you? I still have you.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I can hear you. Okay.
Yeah, you're a little faint with me also, but
You know what? They're sitting there at the network, and they probably heard what we just said, and they should amp that up. Okay.
Okay. That'd be great.
Okay.
That'd be great. The thing that I'm convinced of after 20 years of practicing is that what ails most of us is a function of the fact that we no longer live within the boundaries that nature established for us initially. When we were living closer to nature, there were certain behaviors that were automatic. We automatically ate whole foods. We were automatically more active. We automatically got the right kind of sleep. There were certain things that were automatic that are not only not automatic anymore, but our current environment actually discourages us from doing them. And so we have to become very, very mindful, very, very conscious to do them. And most people don't even consider it until their bodies begin to break down. And that's when, very often, a person will come to see me and we'll start talking about these elements that produce health. And they're not complicated. They're very, very simple. What I've noticed over the last 20 years is that the smartest people are the most confused about what it is they should and shouldn't be doing, and it really isn't brain surgery. It's very simple, straightforward stuff.
Now, most people end up overeating, and you just don't seem to want to know when to quit. Is there a cause for that? Is there an underlying reason?
Yeah, there are a few underlying reasons, but in a word, we overeat because we're malnourished. One out of five meals eaten in this country is served through the window of a car. Fast food may fill us up, but it doesn't nourish us. Also, 70% of the food that's produced in our country is processed, refined, nutritionally depleted, and food that has been denatured like that is not going to have the raw materials our bodies are looking for. When a body's malnourished, it's going to be sending us signals to continue to eat until it feels nourished. So it may sound paradoxical, but we are overfed and undernourished. So the vast majority of our population is undernourished and overweight, which is kind of strange.
Sam, how do we find the right nutrition? Not even the right food, the right nutrition, the right things to eat. There, you know, we live in a very fast-paced, quote-unquote microwavable society. Everybody's so busy they don't have time for anything, which really causes all of the problems that you deal with.
Yeah.
What do you do? What kind of food do you eat to do to take care of yourself?
You know, it really boils down to priorities. You know, when a person comes in and says to me, well, I'm too busy to cook, or I'm too busy to go to the store to buy fresh food, so I need to stop and, you know, eat at McDonald's. There's a major problem there, because the body doesn't take excuses. Nature doesn't accept excuses. So, you know, we can try to negotiate our way out of this, but there is no negotiation. In other words, our body needs a certain array of nutrients, which come in the form of vegetables and fruit and whole grains and protein sources from clean sources, nuts and seeds and beans and things like that. It's not a complicated thing, but it does require, in our current environment, some mindfulness, because we're not automatically running into it all the time. In other words, you're not going to find it at Jack in the Box. So you have to go looking for it. So it really is a matter of reprioritizing and saying, well, you know, my body's not working all that well for me. I'm going to have to start thinking about doing a few different things. And one of those things is I need to carve out a little extra time to make sure that I nourish this body.
Okay, but in that nourishment, it's not just, well, when I say, you know, we're going to nourish the body, but the what to eat, the where do you get that what to eat? Even if you're eating fruits and vegetables, there's a period of time that it gets shipped to you that loses a percentage of its nutrients. If your digestive system isn't working, you'll lose a percentage there. So obviously,
Michael, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. The average time it takes food to make its way from the farm to our table is about 6 days. It travels about 1,500 miles on average. And in that amount of time, over that amount of distance, our food does lose a fair amount of its good stuff. So the smartest thing to do, you know, if I could wave a magic wand over somebody and get them to shop at their local farmer's market and prepare their own food, that would be the very, very best way to ensure that their body was getting the raw materials it needs. And, it, you know, that does take a little extra time. So there is no shortcut to this, although a lot of health food stores these days are realizing that their customers are very, very tight for time, and they will have a fair amount of stuff pre-prepared that you can just come in, pick up, and eat. And that is helping.
Oh, no question about it. But I really believe that there are so many sources out there that most people don't realize. You know, and if I pick up The Way Back, I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I find inside that book that'll give me my roadmap to get to where I need to be?
Well, The Way Back is written in parable form. Over the last two decades or so, there have been dozens of books written with great information in them, but they are written in a dry how-to fashion. And I think a lot of people don't absorb knowledge very well that way. Parables, for a long time now, have been great ways of delivering information. So I've woven some basic information into a compelling adventure story that a person picks up by virtue of following a protagonist across an arc from being completely, ignorant of how to take care of themselves and suffering the consequences, to learning the few basic things that are required to have vital health. And they would include eating whole, fresh food, getting the right kind of sleep, and we can talk about that because that's very, very critical. Being active, I really don't like the word exercise because being active is way healthier than exercising, and we can talk about the differentiation of those two words too, and also taking the time now and then to detoxify their body. Back when we lived, when we were, you know, cavemen during the Paleolithic era, there were regular cycles of scarcity which allowed our bodies to burn off garbage. But we don't live anymore through times of scarcity. And so we just accumulate waste that we have to make a special attempt to unload. And it's important to do that. So those are the sorts of elements that are discussed within the story.
Okay, but and also too, I know you talk about the destructive power of stress and how to manage it. That's handled through nutrition, also, isn't it?
I know that people eat because they're stressed, and if they're burying their stress under food, that's a problem. I don't personally believe that food is a way of successfully managing our stress. I think there's two primary ways of managing stress, and that would be trying to reduce stress to the best of our ability. In other words, if we have an opportunity to lower our stress in our life, that would be really wise. And then to also have mechanisms for dealing with that stress. The two that I think are the most powerful are meditation and yoga or exercise. Those three things have a very profound effect on the body's ability to discharge stress before it can do us harm. And if it's not managed, it can do us quite a bit of harm. Stress is connected to just about every disease, life-threatening disease you can name.
Sure. Oh, by the way, no question about it, but I've always thought, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, I'm not an expert in health, but I've always thought, you know, for years and years and years now, that based on what you eat, and if you start to gain weight, which is stressful, if you start to, you know, your cholesterol goes up, you have heart problems, and all of these things happen based on the kind of food and the amount of food you're taking in, they could cause all of these things that we talked about also. So my feeling about it is, and again, I'm not a clinician, that if you eat correctly, whatever that means to every individual out there, but if you eat correctly, that's going to be one of the factors that will allow you to reduce the stress in your life.
You're absolutely right, and there is a synergy to all of these elements. These few core self-care elements are all interrelated. They each support one another, and so yes. But I don't want us to incorrectly believe that there's a way of managing stress any other way than dealing directly with it, either lowering it or finding a way to manage it. Surely, if we're carrying 50 extra pounds, it's stressful, and we need to deal with that. But we need to deal with it in the most effective way possible. And I personally don't believe that our food is the very best way of dealing with stress. There are more aggressive ways of lowering our stress.
Yeah. By the way, there's somebody famous in this studio. It's called Barney the Beat Up Bag. Radio Susie just fell off her chair because here we go again.
Barney the Beat Up Bag.
Barney the Beat Up Bag is a the heavy bags the heavy bag boxers use to work out.
Excellent.
Well, there's one of them down here. His job is to get hit. So when there's stress, I put the gloves on and I go take care of Barney, and it gets rid of a lot of the stress really fast. And if I don't smack him around, Sam, he thinks something's wrong with him.
Is this a living being or
it's a stuffed bag. But the point is, it's movement and it's stress reduction, and it's everything you're saying. But this is the way I found out.
Yeah, movement is stress reducing.
Yeah,
being sedentary is stressful, and I'd like to talk about that for a moment.
Please,
our Paleolithic ancestors were automatically active by virtue of the environment they lived in. Hunting and gathering requires us to be active, and our bodies are designed for activity. By comparison, the average modern American leads a very, very sedentary life. One study I just read said that the average person sits for over 10 hours a day, which is more sitting than they do sleeping.
Sure.
And sitting for that amount of time, even if they get up and exercise on a daily basis, still puts them at risk for obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. In other words, being an active couch potato, to quote a phrase, is not enough protection from sitting around too much. And so it's more important to be active, meaning to find ways of incorporating movement into your daily life, than it is to sit around and then go exercise for 45 minutes a day. It's not enough. And that's really an eye-opener. I think a lot of people would be very surprised to learn that fact. And I don't know the answer for a lot of people. In other words, if a person sits at a desk for a living, they just need to find ways of standing up. And they need to find excuses to get up on a regular basis and be on their feet, so that their body, which is designed to move, is moving and doesn't fall prey to these diseases of the modern world.
No question. Now, by the way, Sam, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website that we can find you at, get the book, and get more information?
Sure. The way back is available through Amazon.com or at www.thewayback.com. If they're looking to get a hold of me, they can do that at rosenutrition.com. And I'd be very happy to talk to.
Yeah, by the way, Sam, if anybody missed it, it'll be up on our website, so they'll get to see it.
That's terrific.
Wonderful. Hey, Sam Rose, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, I enjoyed the conversation.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening. It would help if the microphone was on. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Stan Levinson with us, holds a BS, an MA, and a PhD degrees, author of 5 books. His big time fundraising for today's schools is used by schools around the globe. He's been interviewed on radio, TV, the press for his fundraising expertise and his extensive public speaking experience telling his stories. And we are talking now about his current book, When Brooklyn Was Heaven, a memoir from a Brooklyn to Los Angeles and places in between. Stan, hey, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm happy to be here, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. When Brooklyn Was Heaven, what were the years you were talking about? 40s, 50s?
Okay, the book covers the years 1931 to 1961.
Wow.
And I'm an old guy, you see, and the book covers those years. It goes way back when.
Were you around in the 30s?
Yes, I was.
Ah, okay. No, this
is
great.
I was around in the 30s. And
go ahead.
Yeah, I was around in the 30s and was living in Brooklyn at the time.
I got to tell you one thing that I've experienced. I'm a product of the 40s, and the early 40s, and I experienced the life that one of the reasons I'm going to love doing this interview tonight when Brooklyn was heaven. We come from, you got a few years on me, but we come from a world that a lot of the kids, a lot of people will never know, from a culture that was so different than it is today.
You're absolutely right, Michael. And were you brought up in the New York City area?
I was brought up in Los Angeles.
Okay.
I was born in Chicago.
It was probably a little different.
Oh, different, but at the same time, the values pretty much were the same. I remember a world, Stan, where, you know, we didn't lock our houses up. If a couple of kids got into a fight, somebody got a bloody nose, you became best friends, and that was the end of it. It was a different kind of a world.
It was, yes. I felt very safe during that time, and my parents trusted us, and especially my mom, because my dad passed away when I was 4 years old.
Yeah.
And so my mom raised me, and of course I lived in Brooklyn in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so I cut across that time period, and it was a wonderful time to live in New York City.
Oh, I'm sure it was. When you're talking about Catskill Mountains being the Borscht Belt, we used to call Fairfax the Borscht Belt in Los Angeles.
I've been to Fairfax, and of course, you know, I'm living in San Diego right now, so I know L.A. Quite well. In fact, I moved to L.A. in 1957, and we spent time there, and I ended up teaching in the Manhattan Beach schools. I started out in L.A. Unified, and then I also taught in Manhattan Beach and Palos Verdes.
Oh, okay.
So I know L.A. My daughter lives there.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, anyway, I'm happy to be on your show and to talk about those days and anything else you want to talk to me about.
Oh, and absolutely. Going back as a kid in Brooklyn in those days, what did it look like? What did it feel like to you? How different was it than it is today?
Okay, it was very different. One of the things growing up. There were horses and wagons on the streets of Brooklyn and other boroughs in New York City, and these horses and wagons were used for various purposes. A lot of people sold goods off of these horses and wagons. I got to move with my grandpa Zadie, helped move us by horse and wagon. From Flatbush to Borough Park, where we ended up living, and my grandpa asked me if I wanted to ride on the horse with him, and I was just a little kid at the time, and I was thrilled about going through the streets of Brooklyn on the horse and wagon, and I think the kids were looking up and envying me for doing this. There were also many things. Many items were sold off of horses and wagons in New York City, including fruits and vegetables. And these people would sell fruits and vegetables off these wagons, and had an interesting experience. I had my first experience when I was playing the outfield in a stickball game on the streets of Brooklyn, and the police came by this horse and wagon, and they were not allowed to stand in one place if there were no customers there. They had to keep moving so they didn't compete with the stores. And I was playing the outfield in a stickball game one day, and I was probably 13 years old at the time. And I noticed the police officer go by and greet the person who owned the horse and wagon. And the owner of the horse and wagon put a $10 bill into a paper sack, and then put a bunch of grapes into the paper sack, and greeted the officers and handed them this sack with the $10 on the bottom and the grapes on the top.
That's
I went
funny.
Home and asked my mom. I said, "Mom, I saw something was a little weird. I had never, you know, I was a little, I was young and wasn't experienced and things like that. And my mother let me know what was going on. And in those days, there was some graft, you know, with the police department, and it was a different time. It was a different place. And of course, the other thing that we did a lot, Michael, and I know people talk about this sometimes on some of the talk shows, but we used to play stickball and punch ball on the streets of Brooklyn, and we made up our own games. We were all poor in those days. It started out during the Depression, and of course, we were dirt poor. Our family, I never got to sleep in a bed. I always slept on a couch growing up, never had my own room. And we used to play these wonderful games on the streets of New York, stickball, punchball, and became quite adept at these games. And we would make up some of our own games as well. And a lot of the people who lived in New York at the time remember these wonderful games that we came up with, and they didn't cost any money to play these games. We made them up ourselves, and including one of the things we also did was we made our own wagons out of 2x4s and old wooden fruit boxes we'd get from the fruits and vegetables store, and we would make up our own carts and take a roller skate and open it and take it and make it into two parts, you know, the ones that you would clamp to your shoes in the old days.
Oh, sure.
And we would put the front to the front of the 2x4, and then the back would go to the back of the 2x4, and then we'd put a box on top, nail a box to it, and we had our own wagons. We weren't overwhelmed with all of the gifts that kids receive today, and they get so much that they are actually overwhelmed with stuff that the parents give to kids nowadays. They don't appreciate it like we did, I think, in those days.
No, not at all. Go back to those days. Did you smoke in those days?
We smoked a little bit in those days, and used to be able to buy cigarettes for a penny a piece.
There you go.
In those days, and a lot of times we would try to we were like a lot of junior high and high school kids. We wanted to be bigger than we were, and we thought that smoking would make us look bigger and older and smarter, and so we tried a lot of this stuff, and then of course when I got into college I started smoking Crookes cigars that are dipped in rum, and we smoked our pipes with mixture 79 tobacco because we thought it would attract the girls, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that, because I remember, and we look at things today that was in the market, what was it about, 6 months, a year ago, and I haven't touched a cigarette in years and years and years. And I walked by the place where they were selling the cigarettes. They were like $70-some-odd a carton. I remember when I was a kid, they were 18 cents a pack. And gas was...
got to be a little crazy to pay those prices nowadays.
Oh, absolutely. I go back when a soda was, it was 7 cents, five cents for the soda, 2 cents for the deposit. There's a whole different world.
Exactly. I remember those. I remember those days, and my sister... Michael, I have two older sisters, thank God, they're still living, and one is 85 and the other is 90, and my oldest sister, Edith, who lives in Las Vegas at this time, she would tell stories about the old days even before I was born, and also during World War II, she used to go to these dances at Luna Park in Coney Island. Coney Island, by the way, was a wonderful place to go as a kid, and where she would pay 10 cents a dance, where they would go in and dance. And a lot of times, when there weren't enough guys around, the girls would dance with the girls, but it was all in a lot of fun. They'd go and pay a dime, and then they'd dance to Glenn Miller on the boardwalk at Coney Island, or Tommy Dorsey, or some, you know, the other big bands. And so I was happy to hear some of her stories. And the book, by the way, I should mention that the book has 140 short stories. And it's different than most memoirs in that these short stories are also sequential, so that they start you know, in the early years, and they take people through the early 1960s, and then the last chapter actually brings everybody up to date. And so I'm getting a tremendous response from the book, and I'm of course trying to market it as best I could, and especially I want to try to do as much as I can with the New York market, because that's when they read this book, they love all the stories in it.
Oh, no question about that. But that's the whole key. What it does, it holds history. And one of the things that we're losing today, Stan, is history. This is not the America that you and I knew, and it's a completely different place. So if you can capture it in a book, capture it in something, that's the legacy. That's what continues on.
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. You know, for years I've been telling these stories. And right now, I am 80 years old, and I've been telling these stories for years, and my kids have said to me, "Dad, you got to get these stories written down." And I also encourage others. When I go out to speak, I encourage people to get their stories down. And in my case, I happen to put it into a book because I like to write, but others can get their stories down on, you know, on you know, video or to have it taped in some way, and leave these stories for your family and friends, and actually for history, and I know there are stories in this book that just blow people away. They say, "That can't be true. Are you kidding me? That happened when you lived in New York." Things like this.
I think it's great, Sam. We're starting to run out of time now. One time, please, your sure. website, where we can find you, find out what you're doing, and also buy the books.
Absolutely. My website is www.stanlevenson, that's LEVENSON.com. And it's quite easy to get to me. And also, the book is available almost everywhere online. So it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available electronically on iPad and Kindle and Nook and other means. And so I think that people will enjoy the book, and I look forward to hearing from people.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, Stan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate it. You brought back memories for me. You were 11 years old when I was born.
Oh, okay. So I know approximately how old you are.
Oh, you bet. Okay.
Michael, you're doing a wonderful thing for people, for writers, and I really appreciate it. I had a very nice email back and forth with Susan, and she remembers a lot of things in her neighborhood. She talked to me about it and about the how safe it was when she was growing up as well. And so I was very happy to have a chance to chat with her and also with you.
Oh, yeah. She does a wonderful job. Hey, by the way, thank you again so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for having me.
Take care. Good night.
And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after. They've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
With you again. But now the curtain falls.
We did it.